Session number 6042, Reel 1.
Mr. Adams, Reel 1. You joined the army in 1939, Mr. Adams. Could you tell me how that came about?
Precisely, I had been in the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve pre-war. I'd been accepted for it. And when the war started, they sent me a letter stating that it would be many months before I would be called up because of the lack of training facilities. So I did go up to visit the local REFVR centre, which was at Birmingham, and it was made quite plain that I was number 297 or something on the waiting list. My brother-in-law, who had been number 8 at this unit on the waiting list, had in fact been called up in June and had been trained as a pilot before the war started, and he quickly went into the Royal Air Force and to operations. However, I thought, like many thought, that the war would be over by Christmas. So one Monday morning, instead of going to work, I told no one, I went to Birmingham, which was about 15 miles from home, to the YMCA in Dale End, to the recruiting centre, and joined the queue. And when I got to the queue, I first went to the REF stand, and they said they were only taking cooks for the duration, that all other duties were closed because of the lack of training facilities. I then went to the Navy, and they said they were only taking people on 6 and 6 engagements, you know, 6 years with the colours, 6 years with the reserve. So that was out. And they said, go to the Army because they are taking people for the duration of hostilities. So I went along to the Army desk or table with a blanket on, as normal. And they said, yes, we are taking duration only, but only for 4 regiments. REMC, RESC, REOC, and 1 other regiment. They said, you can't join the army for anything but that for the duration. You can join the army in any regiment if you sign on a 6 and 6 or a 9 and 3 engagement. And I said, well, what is there? What do these regiments do? And they said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a butcher. They said, well, you obviously go into the RESC. Do you want to do that? And I said, yes. And they said, well, you are over 21. I said, no, I'm 18. They said, well, we're not allowed to enlist duration people unless they're over 21. And they suggested I came back the following day and said I was 22, which I did, and I was in the army. And they then asked me when I'd like to go to the army, and I said, well, when can I go? And they said, what about next week? And I said, all right, next week. So they issued me with a warrant, and I reported at Aldershot.
Did you, in fact, find that your skills as a butcher were made use of in the RASC?
When I got to Aldershot, of course, we were given some recruits training, but they had an inadequacy of everything there. They didn't even have accommodation for us. We slept in mule stables. And certainly the nearest I got to meet there was seeing a few mules. Because, you know, the RESC operated animal transport companies. That was what the mules were for. But after some recruits training and the complete chaos at Aldershot, when you got part of a uniform, you know, you got the top and not the bottom, and that sort of a thing, and it became quite chaotic. And when a time came to volunteer to go somewhere else, I said I would go somewhere else. And all you needed to do is, when you knew someone was going somewhere else, was to get in the first few ranks on parade, and then when they counted off 30 men to go there, 20 to go there, you automatically got yourself sent off. At this stage, I hadn't got an army number or anything. They hadn't got around to that. I was put on a charge by a military policeman in the town of Aldershot for not carrying a service respirator. But, of course, I got off that because I hadn't been issued with a service respirator. And when the first draft came up, they said they wanted 20 butchers to go to Catterick. So I disclosed I was a butcher again, and they said, oh, well, you go to Catterick. So we were marched down to the station by a chap with a drum and a trumpet and went to Catterick in Yorkshire, where I was officially mustered as a butcher, which got me the pay of 2 and 9 pence a day. Because I was a tradesman.
Now, we can't go into your early service in detail, but later on, you found yourself, in 1941, on your way to the Far East. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, the butchering I did at Catterick consisted of carrying quarters of frozen beef weighing anything from 200 to 250 pounds from trucks to a cold store. Now, that isn't exactly what a butcher's made out to be. And during the great freeze-up of 39-40, I was sent up to the headquarters with a group of others to help clear snow because Catterick became blocked, the railway lines became blocked, so there was no meat coming in. So they sent a batch of butchers up to the headquarters at Bapaume Lines to do snow clearance. And it was cold. We'd only got one uniform and our uniforms got wet. And whilst taking shelter near the headquarters, I said to a staff sergeant there, have you got any jobs for clerks here? Anything to get out of the weather? And he said, yes, if they are clerks. I said, well, I can do shorthand typing, bookkeeping, and I've got school certificates in this, that and the other. He said, can you do shorthand? I said, yes. He said, you're just what we want. So I was immediately remustered as a clerk.
Was it true that you could do all those things?
Oh, yes, yes. And I became the colonel and the captain's shorthand typist. When the Norwegian campaign came on, I, with three others equally qualified as shorthand typists, were sent down to Kensington Palace Barracks in London to become cipher clerks for the Norwegian campaign at the War Office. But 3 days after we got to Kensington Palace Barracks, the Norwegian campaign folded and we were just hanging about there. And we went back onto the square doing drill. And whilst we were there, all four of us were interviewed by the CO, a major, and he recommended me for a commission. And he recommended one of the others for a commission. And Basil Howard, he asked to be transferred to the Air Force as a pilot. He, in fact, did get transferred to the Air Force as a pilot, and he was killed later on. But then I was posted from Kensington Palace Barracks to headquarters, Home Counties area in Sevenoaks. Of course, my papers by this time carried the recommendation for a OCTU, not to be commissioned directly, but to go to Officer Cadet Unit. I got there, and by this time, of course, Dunkirk had happened, and there was a bit of a shambles. And Home Counties area quickly moved to Tunbridge Wells, and they formed an army corps called 12th Corps, which was made responsible for the defence of Kent and Sussex. And I was at headquarters 12th Corps, and I carried on doing my shorthand and clerking for a colonel and three or four majors and a captain at 12th Corps headquarters. And then my papers caught up with me, and the colonel said, I see you were recommended for a commission, we'll get it going. So I went to Chatham, to what turned out to be the Royal Engineer Barracks, to be interviewed. And they said, yes, we are going to recommend you for a commission, but you're very young. I was then only 19. We're going to put any action delayed for 6 months till you become older. And to cut a long story short, in 1941, I was sent to Bournemouth, to the RESC. Officer Cadet Unit. And because I did rather well on the course, the first three people on the course had their choice of postings. So we went in individually to see the colonel, and he gave us a list of units that needed officers, or at least all units needed officers, but it was the list. And I said, which units are going abroad soon? And he said, these three. It was 1st Armoured Division, which was going to North Africa, 18th Division, which is what I joined. And then he said, but there's another draft of officers going to Abyssinia to an animal transport company. And in view of the fact that you've had experience with horses and cattle, what about that? We were very short of officers. I said, no, I'll go to 18th Division.
Where were they due to go to, according to the list?
They were just, on the list, they were just put down Middle East. History books tell us where their destination was at the time. Churchill had offered Stalin two British divisions and a wing of Hurricane fighters to go to the Caucasus as a token force to show the Russians we were going to help them. And we set off for the Middle East, equipped with tropical and winter clothing. And but when we were 2 days out of Cape Town, of course, we made history crossing the Atlantic because we were carried from Canada onwards by the US Navy, and USA was then neutral. So, and even across the Atlantic for most of the way, we had a US naval escort, a gigantic one. But 2 days out of Cape Town, we were in an American convoy of all American ships under the American flag, no British flags at all, and the Japanese came in the war. So we were putting into Cape Town for refueling and the usual 3 or 4 days the British troops had there. Some went into Cape Town, some went into Durban and other ports, but we went to Cape Town. And then it became obvious that our destination was in doubt. Our destination, we discovered, had been Basra, where the plan was that we would train in Persia and then move up to join the southern wings of the Russian armies. But that went out of the window. Instead, we were sent to India. Two brigades and most of the corps troops were sent to India. One brigade went directly to Malaya, the 53rd Brigade, arriving there in mid-January. We went to India and there regrouped. Of course, one of the problems was that the transports carrying our equipment were in a big merchant navy convoy, which was much slower than us and hadn't caught up with us. But it caught up with us whilst we were in India, or some of it did, and I was given the job with two other officers of staying in Bombay to reload the ships or to supervise and protect the army equipment on board the ships. We were in India for 3 weeks. By this time, of course, I was a second lieutenant. I left England as a second lieutenant. And then we set off. I'm now speaking with hindsight from reading official histories and army histories. Our first destination was to be Burma. But by the time we'd gone round the bottom of India, Burma had been dropped, and we were to be sent to Java. Our particular little group of ships, of four ships, did in fact put into the port of Batavia, Tanjung Priok, and we got all our kit on the deck ready to unload there when the cry came, leave Java and go to Singapore. So we went off to Singapore. We were attacked by Japanese bombers. The convoy was quite badly mauled.
Could I ask you at this point whether there had been any attacks on your ship before this particular attack? Once you'd left UK, had your ship been attacked at all?
The ship was not attacked at all until we got to the Sunda Straits. That's the straits separating Java from Sumatra.
Could you describe to me in as much detail as possible what you saw personally of that attack?
Well, it wasn't a very successful attack by the Japanese. It was 27 very high-level bombers dropping bombs on a group of ships. None of them hit anything, and our escorts, which included the very famous cruiser HMS Exeter, firing their 4-inch and their 8-inch guns, drove them off. It seemed to be a nuisance raid. But shortly after this, we passed into the port of Tanjung Priok.
Which particular ship were you on, personally?
I was on a free-fin ship called the Felix Roussel. And it, that day, by the way, the day of these bombers attacking us was my 21st birthday. They interrupted my 21st birthday party at noon. I had to leave the birthday party to go out to take all the usual things about air raids.
So what happened to you at Tanjung Priok?
Nothing. We just waited around for a few hours with our kit ready to unload, you know, all brought up on deck. And then the order came, put it all back where it came from, and we sailed off for Singapore.
And what was your first impression of Singapore once you arrived, of the situation there?
Well, bear in mind that we were being heavily attacked in the hours approaching Singapore, and one of the ship next to us, the Empress of Asia, had in fact been set on fire from stem to stern and had been abandoned and sunk by a British and an Australian warship to prevent it falling into enemy hands or blocking the channel or anything. Our ship had been mildly set on fire, but we'd put it out. Our ship, the Felix Roussel, shut down four Japanese aeroplanes, because this time it was a low-level attack. And in fact, the ship got the Croix de Guerre for shooting down four Japanese aeroplanes. And we docked in Singapore without tugs because there were none away, there were none about, and without any dock labourers because they'd all skived off. We docked and bounced against the quay in doing so at 1 o'clock on the morning of the 6th of February. And you may know that Singapore surrendered on the 15th of February and the Japanese landed on the 8th of February. So really, we only just beat the Japanese to it. As we got off the ship, some Australian Army lorries, Army Service Corps lorries, pulled up. And in fact, but for the fact that they'd been there, there'd have been no one to take the ropes that the ship threw off to tie it to the docks. Such was the chaos in Singapore docks. And of course, for 24 hours before we got there, we'd seen the great smoke clouds coming from the bombed oil refineries and buildings. We'd seen them just 24 hours before. I can see them now as great black clouds all along the horizon. We got off at 1 o'clock in the morning, or shortly after 1 o'clock, and these Australians took us to some private houses that had been requisitioned in Bournemouth Road, Singapore, which seemed rather ironic. I'd been commissioned in Bournemouth, and there I was in Bournemouth Road. 3 days before arriving in Singapore, the two RASC companies aboard the Felix Roussel had been told that there was no equipment for us in Singapore or Java, and we had in fact been reformed into number one Rifle Battalion RASC. And my company, 55 Brigade Company, had become A Company, number one Rifle Battalion RASC. So all the equipment we had in Singapore were personal arms and Bren guns and boys' anti-tank rifles. That was the nature of our equipment. We had no transport because it was on a merchant ship somewhere else. And not that we needed it because, as you probably know, Singapore Island is only the size of the Isle of Wight, 32 miles by 16 miles, and it was already crowded with transport. Couldn't be used anyway. After a night in Bournemouth Road, whilst we regrouped, and ironically we were given a grindstone to sharpen our bayonets, because officers don't carry bayonets, but the troops were. And on the later morning of the 6th of February, having had a bad night's sleep at Bournemouth Road, we moved off to Hill 85 on the northeastern coast Singapore to take our part in the defences of Singapore Island. And after 2 days there, We were the reserve troops. There were some Norfolks and other regiments in front of us on the beach and whatnot. We were the first reserves. After 2 days there, I came down very severely with dysentery and dengue fever, and I was evacuated to Civil General Hospital in Singapore because all the army hospitals were full up. But Civil General Hospital was getting its share by this time of bombs, and whilst I was there, it came within range of even the big mortars of the Japanese, and certainly in the range of the field artillery of the Japanese.
Were there any hits on the hospital?
Oh, yes, there were some hits on the hospital, not on the part I was. I know, I can remember that during one air raid, the sister came along. I had a very high temperature with this dengue fever, and I had this dysentery problem. I was in a room with a merchant navy officer from Blue Funnel Line, who'd been taken ill and his ship had left Singapore, and they left him there. And I remember in a sort of haze, presumably from fever, I remember protesting when I was ordered or helped under the bed, and they put the mattress over me under the bed. But after 2 days there, I became discontented, the thought that the battle was going on, and odd casualties kept coming into the hospital and telling us where the Japanese were. And it didn't mean a lot to me because we had no maps. The unit were never issued with maps because the story is, and I've seen it confirmed since, that the British copies of the maps of Singapore Island and southern Malaya were lost when the British lost Kuala Lumpur, and there were some trucks there with masses of maps on which the Japanese captured. Not that they'd really need them, because the Japanese maps of the area were better than the British maps. But people told me, I remember particularly an Australian lieutenant who'd been wounded in the arm, trying to show me. Anyway, I asked the sister if I could discharge myself, and she said, no, you can't, there's no point in you being discharging yourself. You are the place is lost anyway. And she said, we've had orders for some of the nurses to evacuate. And of course, history tells us that they did, and the nurses that evacuated on the 13th of February, in fact, most of them were lost or massacred in subsequent events, part of which was the subject of the recent television program called Tenko. And several of my friends of later POW life, they lost wives in that evacuation, that last-minute evacuation. I think it's rather interesting that when we dropped anchor in Singapore Roads, the opportunity was taken to bury the dead from the air raids, bury them in the sea. And a staff officer from Malaya Command Headquarters came aboard, and all the officers and NCO and sergeants were summoned to the lounge to hear him. And his first words that I can recall were, I don't know what they've sent you here for, but once you tie up at the docks, we want you to get off as quickly as you can, because we need this ship to evacuate women and children in the Royal Air Force. That, of course, was very encouraging, I don't think. So I did discharge myself from hospital, walked out of the hospital, which is a modern hospital, which was a very modern hospital then, and walked into the square and just stopped the first army vehicle that came along. And the first army vehicle that came along was, in fact, an ambulance of a field ambulance. And it was one of our own company who was driving it. His name was Gertz. And I said, Gertz, what are you doing here? He said, I lost the unit when they moved from Hill 85. And I said, where are they? He said, I haven't the slightest idea. He said, it was a shambles, and I lost the unit there. And he said, where do you want to go? I said, I want to go to wherever you're going. He said, well, I'm going back to the field ambulance now to report. So I said, take me there. Is it an 18th Division one? He said, yes. So I got to the field ambulance, and I saw a senior officer there, a doctor, of course. And I said, do you know where 55 Brigade Company are? He said, I haven't a clue. He said, I don't know where anyone is. He said, the Northumberland Fusiliers are just over there, and the anti-tank regiment's down there. So he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to the Northumberland Fusiliers because I know all of the Fusiliers because we've been on the ship with them. And he said, well, while you're there, would you like to take this group of stragglers that are hanging around the field ambulance? And I said, where to? He said, hand them over to the Fusiliers. Because we don't want them around here. They should be doing something. So I set off with them across this road and then up a field. And many roads in Singapore have deep drains alongside them for draining monsoon or heavy rain. And while we were going up there, we came under mortar fire. And I ordered everyone into the drain, which was dry, by the way. Ordered everyone into the drain, and when the mortar fire lifted, there were only about half a dozen blokes left. The others had, I suppose the expression is, scarpered. And I finally reported to the Fusiliers and handed the men over to them, and I asked the Fusiliers if they knew where the RASC were. He said, we don't have the slightest idea. So I walked back down the road, saw to this two-pounder anti-tank gun and its crew, and I said, they were in 18th Division too. And of course they knew us because they'd been on the ship that had been sunk, the Empress of Asia, and our unit had treated them that first night in Singapore from the burns they'd had, and in fact had used up all our own first aid supplies. And they said they hadn't got a clue, and I became a bit discouraged. It all seemed a bit of a shambles. But eventually I saw another truck coming who took me to 18th Divisional RASC headquarters. And there they didn't know either where 55 Company were. Because 55 Company, who'd become part of No. 1 Rifle Battalion, of course had been taken out of the control of the RASC colonel. They'd been handed over to 54 Infantry Brigade and had become infantrymen. As a point of interest, they were, in fact, occupying positions on Clunie Hill, Singapore, near the Chinese Cemetery. And as a by the way, I visited that area 10 months ago when I went back to Singapore. I suppose my own nearest miss in Singapore was when we were moving from Bournemouth Road to Hill 85. The CO sent me on ahead, about an hour ahead on a motorbike, to go and find out where it was and stop them when they came to the road, because bear in mind we had no maps. And whilst I was going along this bit of road towards Hill 85, there were a couple of trucks behind.